You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's show, our studio guest is Martine McDonagh, talking about her debut novel, I Have Waited and You Have Come, and her latest, Narcissism for Beginners. We'll also hear from poet Helen Ivory, and stonecutter and author Leda Kindersley will be talking to us as well. But first of all, hello Martine, welcome to the show.
Hello Lee, thank you for inviting me.
Nice to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, and we will of course throughout the show be hearing your three choices of music. You have a professional relationship to music as well as a personal one, don't you?
I do, yes. I worked in the music industry for approximately 30 years in various guises, but mostly as an artist manager.
So what does an artist manager do?
Well, it depends very much on what stage the band is at in their career, but ostensibly, you manage the band's career.
The whole thing.
You do everything. And, I mean, in the very early days, you'd probably be more involved in booking shows, actually going on the road with the band, maybe. And later on, obviously, the more successful a band gets, then you'll have a booking agent. So, and a whole team of people around the band, which the manager then is charged with responsibility for making sure that team's doing everything that you need them to do, and you coordinate everything. So you always have an overview of the band's career, whatever it is they happen to be doing.
And will we know some of the people you work with?
I managed James for 10 years.
Brilliant. James, sit down and...
Which I sang backing vocals on.
You did, and did you?
I did, yeah. Oh. Purely for convenience rather than talent. I hope
what so. A thing to be able to drop into a conversation.
And then I managed various people for kind of shorter periods of time. And I managed a band called Fujie Miyagi for 8 years. And that was the last kind of long-term relationship I had with a band, and I've done bits of consultancy since then, but I've slowly over the last few years kind of moved away from the music industry.
Was it all sex, drugs and rock and roll? Please tell me. Don't disabuse me. Was it
not from my point. Yeah, lots of that, lots of tired long nights. No, it's not very glamorous when you're actually involved in it.
Just looks more glamorous from
the
outside.
It can be fun. It can be really good fun. And you come across lots of sex, drugs and rock and roll, obviously. But particularly as a manager, you can't afford to get involved in all that.
Of course not. Of course not. Well, you mentioned there Fujie Miyagi. That's
yes.
How you pronounce it. And that's your first choice of music. This fabulous track that I hadn't heard before. So why this one?
Well, this one particularly because I love songs that tell stories. I'm not really interested in... I don't have a lot of patience for songs that are just an emotional splurge about being brokenhearted. Dave Best, the singer in Fujie Miyagi, who writes all the lyrics, is a fantastic lyricist. And he always tells little witty stories. And this one in particular is about him breaking his collarbone twice when he was a kid.
Catch her, Ah, the wonderful Collarbone by Fujiya and Miyagi, the first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Martine McDonagh. Martine had a successful career in the music industry, as we heard, and devised and ran the MA in Creative Writing and Publishing at Westdean College in Sussex. Her first novel, I Have Waited and You Have Come, was longlisted for the Authors Club First Novel Award. Radio 4's Open Book said it left an indelible imprint on the psyche, and Red magazine described it as sinister, scary and utterly compelling. In 2018, she published Narcissism for Beginners with Unbound, a crowdfunding platform for books and writers. It's been shortlisted for the 2018 People's Book Prize and longlisted for the Guardian's Not the Booker Prize. Well, Martine, will come on to Narcissism for Beginners and the whole Unbound experience. But let's rewind a little to I Have Waited and You Have Come. For those who haven't read the book, what's it about?
It's set in a climate-changed future. Kind of an unspecified date. It's around 2040 in my head. And the world, it doesn't look very futuristic as we might think of it technologically. It looks more like a very muddy kind of medieval past, and people live in very disparate small communities. And the character at the centre of the book is a woman called Rachel, who's been left by her partner, and she lives on this little island in the middle of a river in an old mill. And she's running out of food and running out of resources and kind of decides to set out and try and find somebody to attach herself to, even though she's not particularly very people-friendly.
And that is what ensues from there. It's interesting you say 2040. It felt much further in the future, maybe, because society really has completely broken down.
Yeah. Well, it was much further in the future when I wrote it. I mean, I wrote it in 20... I started it in about around 2000. So it felt a lot further away at that point. But all the climate change research I did kind of pointed to that being an accurate prediction in terms of the world. Basically, the main kind of catastrophe that's happened is there's been loads and loads of flooding. And so she lives in the flatlands of Cheshire, which has suffered very badly from flooding. So it's become quite inaccessible.
And why that particular subject? Was that something that interested you? You thought, you know, I feel strongly about this, I want to write a book about it. Or was it something setting it in that kind of time allowed you to explore other issues?
It was mostly an interest in climate change and frustration, really, because it wasn't that long ago, relatively, but really any discussion about climate change revolved around, oh, it'll be great, you know, the weather's going to get warmer, we can grow our own grapes, we won't be so dependent on other countries for certain things, you know. And it was fairly low-level engagement with the problem. Not that that's changed too much. And I was absolutely, I found it terrifying, the prospect of climate change. And so I wanted to explore that, and I wanted other people to be scared by it. So I wrote a frightening book.
And everything's broken down in this book, though, hasn't
it's
it?
It's completely, the story is told from the perspective of Rachel, the main character, and she's not particularly reliable narrator. So from her point of view, the world is very broken down. And yes, I mean, I envisaged it as fairly broken down, but actually people function very well. It just functions very differently. There are no shopping centres anymore. They're just kind of shops where people go and trade stuff. They'll take things and trade them for food. So it's more small community orientated world.
Yeah, it felt medieval in that sense. So yeah. Encampments and bartering, yeah, and that kind of thing.
But some strange little cults as well. I'm a bit obsessed by cults. And so there are these little cults that have kind of sprung up too. And Rachel's terrified of everybody. She's not very sociable.
Yes, Rachel. Let's come on to Rachel. She's a bit of a mystery, even to the reader, I think.
Even to herself, I think, perhaps.
What about to you?
No, I've kind of got a fairly good handle on her.
Where does she come from?
She comes from, geographically.
Well, no, generally.
Oh, generally.
In terms of character development, yeah.
I think she just kind of materialised, really. I wanted to write a book with a female character who wasn't necessarily a good character. That actually she was someone, because I think the representation of women in books generally is quite positive, or, you know, they're presented in a fairly stereotypical way with a certain set of characteristics that everyone can relate to. But actually, you know, there are a lot of women out there who really aren't very nice and quite manipulative and dark. So she's a very dark character.
She's very earthy. She's very visceral, isn't she? She never changes her clothes. I think she might change her clothes.
No, she's filthy. What? She stinks.
Yeah, she slides out of bed on all fours.
If she even goes to bed, she often sleeps on the sofa.
And yeah. She sleeps a lot.
She sleeps a lot.
And she eats the most disgusting things. I mean, there's a real sort of sense of her there. You really brought her to life in that respect.
Yeah. She's not a pleasant character. I mean, she's not someone you'd want to be around necessarily. So I also wanted to write a non-sympathetic female character. That was quite important to me to do that. So I think I succeeded.
You did, but we're still, you know, we're still batting for it, if you like. You know,
yeah,
we're still on her
you
side.
Have to be able to relate to her, I think. And I also, I suppose the other kind of model that I had in my head was Bridget Jones and chick lit. Effectively, I wanted to write an anti-chick lit novel.
She's very different to Bridget Jones.
She's very different to those, you know, those kind of female characters. And I just wanted to write a character that she's still got the same problems as those characters. You know, she wants to find a partner.
She's still longing for a relationship.
Nowhere near as well equipped as Bridget Jones to find a partner.
And the whole idea of relationships is quite functional in this age. There's a sort of Handmaid's Tale-esque style to them.
Yeah, and she very much is, you know, she doesn't want to look after herself, so she wants to find somebody that will look after her as her ex-partner did. She just doesn't want to be lumbered with the burden of herself.
It's interesting as a reader seeing the world through her eyes, because obviously we're gradually introduced to it, but all through her lens.
Yeah.
So it is disorientating at first, and there's that dramatic irony of trying to know something different from her, seeing things different. You're obviously aware of that when you were writing.
Yeah. It was quite hard to do that, and I don't know how successful it is. I haven't read it since it was published. So
no. Really?
No.
You haven't gone back to...
I've read snippets, so, you know, for at readings and things like that, but I've never actually sat down and read. I can't, because I'd just rewrite it.
Yes, I understand that. Yes, a lot of writers say that. And I suppose you're on to the next thing, aren't you? Once you've dealt with that, you're moving on.
Yeah, there's no reason to read it, really, other than to just make yourself feel really depressed.
Well, thank you, Martin. We'll come back. We will talk more about, you know, we won't depress ourselves. We will talk more. Yeah. But we'll take a sideways step for just a moment to hear from Leda Kindersley. Leda carves letters in stone and other media. She designs typefaces and runs the Cardoza Kindersley Workshop. She's written 25 books on her practice, as well as a graphic novel about the early life of her late husband, the sculptor and letter cutter David Kindersley. Her workshop on Victoria Road has also been home to a poet in residence, Chris Kington, who composed 52 poems about the work taking place there. And it was at that workshop that I met Leda, and she showed me, amidst the bust of activity there, some of the work being undertaken at the moment by her and her team, ranging from gravestones to public art and private commissions. But first, she started by telling me the very basics of what she and her colleagues do.
We cut letters in stone. That's the main sort of thing we do. In fact, we cut letters, we make letters, we draw letters. I've drawn some typefaces. You can look around Cambridge and see David's lettering, street lettering. That is designed by him in the 40s, a long time ago, and it's become part of not just Cambridge, of the British Isles. In fact, when we went to see the first Harry Potter film, the owl alights on a sign and it said Privet Drive in David's lettering. It's slightly quirky, but it's incredibly legible, and that's why it's been chosen all round. So lettering is the thing. The typeface is a letter form that is usually designed to be read quite small, 12, 14 point. What we do is huge for the British Library, for instance. The T for the British Library is 2 metres tall. That is not a typeface. That's not a font. That's a letter form. Everything we do here is new. We draw everything afresh. Of course, we draw it with the knowledge we've got in our heads. So it might look the same every time for anybody else. I've done this now for over 40 years, and people say, oh, Are you not getting bored? Another A? And I said, no, I mean, I haven't cut this A yet. This is going to be the perfect, it's never perfect, but this is going to be the perfect one, of course. And then I think, okay, well, the next one. The next one's going to be perfect. So that keeps the excitement. And a typeface means that you repeat the letter form you've done before. And that's exactly what we don't do. We're doing the Stations of the Cross for Little St. Mary's, which is interesting because there are 14 pieces. And so they have to hang together. And yet each text is quite different. So the format is the same. They're square and they're about 12 inches across. So you've got the same sort of shape to work on, and yet the letter forms can be different because it says different things. That's one rather wonderful commission. I mean, it's a once or twice in a lifetime one. We've just finished a stone for William Blake that was unveiled in August. So that was a great thing to work on because William Blake, I mean, I'm quite a fan anyway. At the same time, we carved something for Stephen Hawking. And Stephen Hawking, of course, was also a stargazer like Blake, but very different. A man of this time, a scientist, whilst Blake, of course, was much more of a philosopher and a religious, motivated, quite eccentric. They probably both were quite eccentric. But so there's a wonderful way of trying to get into what it is for, where it is going. What we're actually doing here is making something last. And making it last, you use stone because it's a wonderfully tough material. The thing about being a stone cutter is if you commission something, we then make it, it's put out there, and that's it, gone. And so although we have thousands, literally thousands of stones out on the British Isles and the rest of the world, they're all dispersed. And so I think it's really wonderful every now and then to do a book. For instance, when we started the Cambridge book that was commissioned by Cambridge University Press, the printer, who was a wonderful man, sort of said, Lida, I keep coming across your stones, but you don't sign it. What do I refer to? I mean, how do I know? I said, well, let's do a book. And he said, great, let's do it. Let's do a coffee table book with all your stones in Cambridge. I said, no, not a coffee table book. We are not coffee table people. It's got to be a little guide you can slip in your pocket. And that's why we have a little series of four books. And one is the colleges. Every single college in Cambridge has got at least one Kindersley. And then we did Cambridge itself. And then we did Cambridgeshire. And then we came back. It was David's centenary of his birth. We came back to describe his life through the bits and pieces we've got in the workshop. It's a wonderful building. We're very lucky to have this sort of Victorian school building where we've got good light and thick walls and lots of space to hang things on and lots of space for all eight of us to work. So that's lucky in Cambridge, isn't it? I did graphic design. I was always interested in shapes and design, you know, making things hang together rather than trying to draw your face absolutely how you are. I went to the Royal Academy in The Hague. I'm from Holland, as you might have picked up by now. The first lesson I had was this man who came and said, okay, we're going to design typefaces. And he drew his name with a flat bit of chalk on the blackboard. And I thought, that's what I need to do. Why didn't anybody tell me this before? You know, I hated school and I was really bad at it. And all of a sudden, everything was, yeah, that's what we need to do. And then I was lucky 2 years later to meet David, who actually made letters right from the beginning. Because when you're a graphic designer, you use typefaces. But when you're a letter cutter, you don't use them, you make them. You start with nothing and you listen to people. That's a part I particularly like. You listen to what people want. I want it to look modern. I want it to look solid. I want it to be elegant. I want flourishes. I don't want flourishes. You know, and that, all that sort of goes in, and I don't quite know how it works. Magically, something then comes out. There are many, many reasons for us to want to hold on to something. So quite often, I lost my own husband when the boys were 6, 8, and 9. So I know what that feels like. You want to hold on to that person. On the other hand, he's not there. But you can hold it in the stone to where it was. You can make a little snapshot and keep it. And that's a very important thing. You can do that with a cat or rabbit. Or you can just think, well, I love sitting in the garden. I just want to say something in the garden, like we're just doing a stone at the moment, a big standing green slate, which says the best is yet to be. I love that. People just came up and said, we want to put that in our garden. I think, what a wonderful thing. The favourite piece, oh, that's one of those questions you can't ask. You know, it's like, what's your favourite piece of music? Sometimes you feel dark and you need Mozart's Requiem, and sometimes you need Vivaldi, and sometimes you need The Doors, and other times you need, you know, The Beatles. It's actually, the short answer is, my favourite piece is what I'm doing now. And if you ask me in 3 months' time, it'll be the same answer, because once I'm in something, to me, that's always the possibility to develop and come up with something new and something fresh and something that really works. Obviously, there are things like the British Library gates or the William Blake now that people say, what do you do for a living? And I say, oh, actually, I'm a stone cutter. The gravestones, you know, people get very gloomy. And I say, well, actually, we did those gates with, and people then realize what it is you're doing. So those highlights are very wonderful. But, you know, if I do a stone for a rabbit and it really matters, I love that. In the day's work, in the day's development, in the day's excitement, to me as important as the British Library gates, but not to the outside world. The first book I wanted to write about apprenticeship, I asked somebody who had written an article about the workshop, and he'd written it beautifully, and I said, well, can you write about apprenticeship? He said, why don't you write it yourself? I said, well, because I'm a stonecutter, not a writer. I can do it, but to step out and then observe what you're doing and describing it so somebody else on is a completely different mindset. So he said, just write it and I will tell you. So I wrote a book, sent it to him. He rang back and said, yeah, Lida, that's completely useless. I will come and help you. I literally got private lessons on how you set up a book, how you analyze what it is you want to say. And it's a completely different thing. But I love it. I really love it. It's good for the brain to do different things, I think. I gave a lecture and this man thanked me for the lecture in a poem. And I said, wow, we should do a book. You should sit in the workshop and write some poems. And he did. He came and he sat quietly for about a year, wrote about 100 poems, I think, or 80, and we chose about 50 or 60 and put them in a book. But then we're in a visual profession. So we then both decided it'd be nice to have some photographs with it, and we found a wonderful photographer who came and made very sharp and precise photographs on what we do with the poems. So, yeah, that was a completely different book again. We called it Red Letters All because it's sort of Red Letter Day, you know, it sounded like a good title. You need to have that balance between being very outgoing and forceful and being very meditative and ingoing. Of course, you need to have your hands and eye connected, so not everybody can draw. So you need to be able to draw and you need to be very good with people. I run a workshop, so there is six of us cutting, two in the office full-time and three part-time people. If you're working away and somebody says, can you just give me a hand? You said, go away, I don't want my brother. That's not going to work. So you have to be always patient and kind to other people. And if somebody comes and said, I've lost my husband and bursts in tears, you can't sit there thinking, oh, come on, you know, get it out. You have to actually really feel compassionate. It's not a matter of learning to be compassionate. You really have to love mankind, which I think is the tallest order of all.
And Cutting Across Cambridge by Leda Kindersley is published by Cambridge University Press, as are many of her books. Red Letters All, a collection of poems by Chris Kington, is published by Cardozo Kindersley Editions. And you can find out more about the work of the workshop at kindersleyworkshop.co.uk. We're talking to Martine McDonagh today on Bookmark. Martine, Leda talking there about the transformation, going from being a stonecutter, a sculptor, to a writer.
And very interesting.
Very interesting. Didn't go quite as smoothly first as she thought it might. What about you? The transition from working in the music industry to writing novels. How did that come about?
Well, I always wrote. I mean, that was, since childhood, I always wrote. I wrote stories, bad poetry. I started off writing screenplays, short stories, and then I decided I wanted to try screenwriting and plays because I studied theatre at university. I kind of tried a few different forms and eventually thought, actually, no, I think maybe I could try and write a novel. So that's how I came to... Then at that point, I decided to go and do an MA myself in creative writing in Manchester. That was about 20-something years ago. And I started writing I've Waited and You Have Come while I was doing that MA.
OK, so that was your first... Shot at it. That's a great success rate.
Yeah, and I think actually working in the music business really prepared me for being an author in other ways in terms of professional practice. I mean, I know what copyright is. I know how to read a contract. I can understand how the industry works a bit. There are many similarities between the two industries, and so that really helped actually.
Well, we'll listen to your second choice of music now, which is Mars by John Grant. Why this one?
This one was my intro music while I was writing Narcissism for Beginners. Sometimes if I'm a bit fidgety and finding it difficult to get to work, I'll pick a song that will be my intro music. So as soon as I start to play it, I know I have to settle down and think about starting to work. So I have a kind of a Pavlovian response to this song.
So if I play this now, you're just gonna...
I might start writing, yeah.
Bittersweet strawberry marshmallow butterscotch, polar bear cashew, Dixieland phosphate chocolate, lime tutti frutti special raspberry, leave it to me. Three gray scotch lassie cherry smash lemon free. I want to go to Mars, where rivers flow.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than boasts.
We're talking to Martine McDonagh today on the Bookmark. You didn't quite get down and start writing there.
No,
with that.
I went to Mars.
Did you? You went to your special place. But that was the music that prompted you to write Narcissism for Beginners. That was your kind of prompt music, getting position and start typing.
Yeah, you should be at your desk now and starting to work. And actually, usually I wouldn't make it all the way through the song before I'd kind of shut down from the music and start working. And
I like that. That's almost like a music industry thing as well, is it? Because certain acts have a certain song that's played on the soundtrack before they come on, don't they?
Yeah, right. It's time to be serious now.
Yes, be a grown-up. So you're going to read an extract from Narcissism for Beginners for us now.
I am. Okay. Just as a little bit of introduction, Sonny Anderson, who's the main character, he's 21 years of age. He has flown to England from America to try to find his mother, and he's meeting people that knew both his parents before he was born. And there's this one character, Marcia Ray, who he's not looking forward to meeting, and he's on his way to meet her now. Marcia Ray is still a pain in the arse. Even hearing her voice on the phone makes my skin creep. She wants to come and meet me at the station. I don't want her to come and meet me at the station. She wants me to stay at her house. I don't want to. With Mrs. C, it was easy. She didn't offer, and I sure as hell didn't want me to. Ruth is awesome. I'd stay with her any time. No way would I ever stay with Marcia Ray. Not for all the fish in the ocean, or however the saying goes. But she won't take no for an answer, like she thinks she has some kind of ownership over me. And the more she insists, the more I don't want to. Even telling her I already booked a place to stay isn't enough to throw her off. I could cancel it and sleep in the room my dad used to sleep in, she says. Like that's going to swing the argument her way. In the end, I lie, make up a bunch of crap about staying with a girlfriend from school. I tell her my imaginary girlfriend is meeting me at Brighton Station. Well, that gets her real excited, and she wants to know all about the girl, ask for names in case she knows her family. I tell her I have to go find my train and that I'll call her tomorrow as soon as I'm settled. She says she'll come and pick me up from wherever I'm staying. I say I'll call her. Some women will do anything to be somebody's slave. I last saw Marcia Ray like 12 years ago in Brazil. She stayed behind after Thomas and I left. I don't remember her physically so much as how I felt about her, which, if you didn't already pick up on it, is not positive. But I want to know what's happened there after we left, and she's the only one who knows. Plus, there's a small chance that maybe you're, that's his mother, still in touch with her. I want to meet in Starbucks. She says Brighton people don't go there, which I soon discover is a lie when I pass by on my way to meet her, and it's as busy as all the other coffee shops. Obviously, she means she doesn't go there, out of some kind of high-minded, self-righteous principle to do with American imperialism or oligarchic capitalism. I heard it all in school, but you know what? In a free society, if people want to drink bad coffee, you have to let them. Still, as my overall aim is to avoid going to her house and suffering the guided tour of where my father slept and where he did a crap every day, etc., etc., it's a small sacrifice on my part to meet any place she wants that isn't there. First observation. Brighton has shopping zombies and bike path zombies like you'd never seen. I always thought they were the special preserve of Redondo in the beach cities. But not so. It also has street drinkers and homeless people begging for money, which you don't see so much of in Redondo Beach. There's a noticeable lack of people of colour. Little kid Sonny found Mrs. F, Marcia Ray, huge and overbearing. And let's just say some things don't change. If you were to pin me down about the detail, to list exactly what it is I don't like about her, I could say it's the horrible simpering voice emanating from the oversized body. But it's more than that. It's beyond physical. There's this gut feeling that stirs even at the mention of her name, and that feeling has a name of its own, suspicion. In real life, putting physical size and emotional expectations, hers, to one side, I'm sure she's a decent enough human being. I just don't like, respect or trust her. End of. The cafe she's chosen is actually pretty cool, and I guess the idea is for me to think that she's pretty cool too for knowing it even exists. The couple cool places in Redondo Beach, this beats them both. It has a store mannequin's hand for a door handle, nail polish and all. It's a little grubby though, and all I can think about is how many people walk right out of the restroom without washing up and reach for the door hand. Marcia Ray is waiting for me right inside. I step back to avoid the inevitable hug lunge, and the door hand jabs me in the kidneys. Immediately, the bombardment begins. Did I eat breakfast? Did I eat lunch? Would I like a slice of cake? And it hits me right away. The reason I never liked Marcia Ray, Mrs. F, call her what you will, she behaved like she thought she was my mother. She still behaves like she thinks she's my mother. And not a kind, caring mother, a controlling, overbearing one. If I had to pick a woman who isn't my mother to be my mother, it wouldn't be her. My ideal mother does not have that voice. However, the cake looks delicious. But since it's been sitting right there on the counter until 3 in the afternoon, uncovered and invisibly spat on by customers making their orders, I say no thanks.
We've all been to cafes like that.
Yeah.
Just a little bit about the Unbound experience for people who don't know. Well, you talk us through the process, how it works and how you found it.
Unbound, you submit to Unbound as you would any other publisher, and they either select your book for publication or don't. So it's no different to any other experience in that sense, except that with most publishers, actually, you can't make a direct submission as an author. You have to go through an agent. which is why I went to Unbound, because I didn't want to work with an agent. And they, if once they choose it for publication, you then you begin the crowdfunding process, basically.
You have to raise how much is about £8,000? Is it?
I had to raise £10,000. It's an awful lot of money to raise, and it's not that easy.
No, that is awesome.
I didn't find it an easy process, but I was interested in it. I thought it was a really interesting kind of model, and in the music industry, I was always interested in finding different ways to do things and to build a band's career through, you know, independent means as much as possible. And so this appealed to me from that perspective.
And they put, and if you raise that amount of money, they publish it and it looks beautiful.
Yeah, it's a proper publisher. They have proper proper distribution. They sold rights to Germany, so it's published in Germany by HarperCollins. And they, you know, they work hard to try to sell rights around the world. Translation rights and film and media rights. Anyway, so I crowdfunded the money eventually. Well, it didn't take me that, as long as I expected. It took about 3 months. And then it takes about a year from that point until it's ready for publication. And anyone who crowdfunds gets a special edition of the book. So a really beautiful hardback with lots of extra bells and whistles that the trade hardback didn't have. So... yeah, it's an interesting process.
Lovely. Well, thank you, Martine. We'll come back to you again, but we're going to hear from Helen Ivory now. Helen is a poet and visual artist. Her semi-autobiographical collection, Waiting for Bluebeard, was shortlisted for the East Anglian Book Awards in 2014. Fool's World, a collaboration with the artist Tom de Freston, won the 2016 Saboteur Award for Best Collaborative Work. Last year, she received an Arts Council Award to work on her fifth collection of poetry, The Anatomical Venus, which will be published in spring next year. I met her when, along with her husband, the poet Martin Figura, she came to the Cambridge Writing Retreat to tutor a course. As we sat in the lounge, and the snaps you can hear in the background are the crackles of an open log fire, I asked her if she'd always known she was going to be a poet.
No, I started off as a visual artist. I went to Norwich Art School, as it was then, and ended up doing a cultural studies degree. And the creative writing tutor was the poet George Surtees, who introduced me to poetry. And I found that it's easier, or I found it easier, making images with words than making images with paint or any other medium, really, because with words you can just say them and the images appear. You don't have to be in a certain place, you don't have to be in a studio, you can do it anywhere, you can carry a poem in your head. So that's how I came to writing poetry. I mean, about 17, I was in a goth band, like most people. And so I was writing songs for that. So I've always been interested in words, but I didn't really know there was such a thing as a poet that you could be, that was a living person.
Things that you're interested in communicating via your art, was they easy to communicate via poetry, or did you find you wanted to talk about different things?
I don't think I knew what I wanted to communicate via art. I was interested in theatre design, and I think that my poems are often little stage sets and theatres and things happen in them. And now I make assemblages. I make boxes where things happen within them and I place things together. But I've only been working like that as an artist on my own. As a theatre designer, obviously you have everything else to consider. You have practical matters. You have, you know, somebody else that does the lighting and, you know, all of that. With a poet, you can control it and do everything yourself and make stuff happen.
But you're married to a poet. Does that help?
Yes, it does help. It just makes all the things that you do normal. And we go along to poetry events. We know loads of other poets, and we have a really good workshop group in Norwich of other poets where we get together every month or so and share work and workshop it and put commas in. Or, you know, tape stanzas out. Or it's good to have all of those eyes, and living with another poet, it's good to be able to just have someone in the house that knows what you're up to and knows what you're doing is important and doesn't think that you're off doing something else that they don't understand.
And are there certain themes that you come back to now and again in your poetry, whether consciously or unconsciously? When you sit down to write a poem, do you think it's going to be about this, but really about this? Or do you just see what happens with the words on the page?
There is usually some kind of transformation that happens. There was a thing recently that poets were doing on Twitter, how to know if you're in a whoever it is poem, so how to know if you were in a Helen Ivory poem. I can't remember exactly what I said, but I think I said something like you would be a wolf, there would be some kind of transformation, there would be a liminal space, and there will be some kind of music happening just offset, which you just can't quite hear what it is. So it's just a hint of something else.
What is it about transformation that interests you? So you've mentioned that a couple of times.
As having the power as a writer to be able to transform things without actually physically having to do it, you can make things happen. Things are always wanting to turn into something else. You can't leave many things alone and expect them to stay that way. So I'm interested maybe in a heightened version of that, somebody changing into an animal. I think people might turn animal in the, but you know, I can make them turn into a wolf in a metaphorical sense.
And what's the process for you of writing a poem? Is there a process that you go through each time, or is each one quite different?
The last book I wrote, which is going to be out next May, they were quite research-based poems, so it was about women and otherness. So I read lots of texts like The Essex Witch Trials and cultural studies texts with that kind of information, because it is information at that stage. You read it and then you need to process it or compost it. So with those poems, I probably need about 3 or 4 days in order for the reading to come in. And it's like making jam. So when you make jam, you have all of the fruit, all of the ingredients. It's transformation. I'm going to say the word transformation again. So you transform all of that into a finished product. So this is what I'm doing with those kind of poems. So that was that book. It's called The Anatomical Venus. And the poems that I've been writing over the summer have been more imagination-based. So I've just been writing really freely, and it's been nice and liberating compared to all the research poems. Because, you know, a poem can take maybe half an hour or something. These ones are really happening fast. Yeah, it's quite an exciting way to work. Not that the other stuff was tedious. The other stuff is more of a puzzle. Having something you want to write about and then writing about it and finding the poem without making the reader think, oh, that's what they wanted to write about, hiding something within something.
And you're here at the Cambridge Writing Retreat, so you've got some tutees who you're teaching over the weekend. This must be quite an enjoyable part of your work.
Yeah, it's really nice. Much of the teaching that I do at the moment is online, so it's nice being in a group of people, in a room with a group of people, and we're all talking in real time. Everyone's generating a lot of work, and it's just really exciting to see these ideas as they happen. And the nice thing also is seeing the surprise on people's faces about something that they didn't know that they were going to write, and then they wrote it and they go, where did that come from? Because we've been looking at some poems that have put people in the right kind of zone, for want of a better word, for these poems to appear. I don't think that they could have written the poems that they've written without reading those first.
And you're going to read some poems for us now.
These poems are from Waiting for Bluebeard. It's a book in two halves. The first part of the book is poems loosely based on my childhood, and the second part, poems about living in an abusive relationship. So this is how it felt to be in my parents' house. The family at night. We were ragdolls after school and passed the long winter evenings like this. Father in his armchair with an unlit pipe. Mother in the kitchen pretending to eat. My sister and I with our small occupations. We saw little with our button eyes and spoke even less with our stitched up mouths. We played at playing till it was time for bed, when mother sewed our eyelids down so we could get a good night's rest. We always woke as our human selves to find the downstairs rooms had altered too. A chair unstuffed, a table's legs all wrong, and that one time kittens gone from their basket, the mother's bone hollow meow. So this is a prose poem. The story of the shed. When his daughters were very small, my father built them a shed right at the bottom of the garden. The shed was no ordinary shed. It was made from wooden pallets and 4-inch nails. It was doorless. The wood was green and still bled in places. In others, skin and teeth were flaking away, ripe for splinters and snags. One day, the shed bit his eldest on the heel of her hand so fierce, a splinter lodged deep in her flesh. Try as she might, no needle would free it, not even a pin from her grandmother's toolbox. She is sleeping still. When she wakes, she will be a harbour for all the lost birds. She will be a living tree. So we lived in, this is my ex and I, Bluebeard, who I've come to call him. We lived in the middle of the Norfolk countryside, and there would often be rabbit hunting. Rabbit season. Woken by the sharp burn of moonlight on her face, she moves to the window, sees searchlights unearthing the season's rabbits, then remembers the child. The last time she'd gone out, she lost her slippers in the river, so now her bare feet carry her down the stairs, along the hallway, over the patio and into a night cut with gunshot. She digs at the edge of the lawn with a spade first, then with her hands to be closer to her work. By dawn, there are little mounds of earth, but still no child. She tidies herself up in time to make Bluebeard's porridge. She watches him emerge from the fields, his mossy boots soaked with dew, a string of rabbit pelts at his waist, all their open eyes.
And Waiting for Bluebeard by Helen Ivory is published by Blood Axe Books, and you can find out more about courses at the Cambridge Writing Retreat at their website, cambridgewritingretreat.com. Our studio guest on Bookmark today has been Martine McDonagh. We've been talking to you, Martine, about your novel I Have Waited and You Have Come, which is published by Myriad Editions, and Narcissism for Beginners, which, as we were just talking about, is published by Unbound. We're coming sadly to the end of our time with you, unfortunately, Martine. So what's now for you? What are you doing at the moment?
Well, I'm writing. I'm quite close to finishing it. It's not a sequel particularly to Narcissism for Beginners, but it's Sonny Anderson's story 21 years on. So he's in his 40s in that story. So and there will be another book to follow that.
Was it always
Sunny
going to
centre?
Be a trilogy? No, really, it's just kind of developed a life of its own.
Yeah, and I'm kind of regretting it now. But
you're locked in now to the three books. Yeah,
and I'm writing another book at the moment, which is a book that I actually shelved about 6 years ago, and I had a gap while Terminal Island, that's the follow-up to Narcissism, was being read by an external reader. So I dragged this one out because I've wanted to work on it for a while. It's called The Experiment, and I'm really enjoying it because I've got none of the hard work to do. I've done it all. I'm just kind of fiddling around with the story.
Oh, that does sound enjoyable.
Yeah. So it's quite a change. And I think maybe that's what I'll always do in the future, is just put something away for 6 years and get it out before I look at it again.
And go back to it. And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading, John McGregor's Even the Dogs.
Enjoying it?
Very much so. I love his writing.
Excellent. Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment for your final choice of music. But just a heads up, our next show is a Christmas show. I know, it's that time of year. And I'll be joined by local writer and broadcaster Rory McGrath to look back on the year in books. We'll also hear from Kate Fleet from Heffer's Bookshop, who'll be telling us what books to put on our list for Santa, if we've been nice, not naughty, that is. And you can find all the podcasts of Bookmark right to the beginning of time, all our shows, on the Cambridge 105 radio website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. So, Martine, we're going to sign out now with your last choice of music. I'm going to need a bit of help from you here pronouncing both the artist and the title.
Okay, it's the track is called Papote, and it's by a Belgian artist, a French-Belgian artist called Stromae.
And why this one?
I get a bit obsessive with particular songs when I hear them, and I love this one. I love it's got very, the lyrically it's quite sad. It's a story of a boy who's with an absent father, basically. And he looks out the window and counts his fingers, counting the days for you know, until his dad returns home. So it's quite sad lyrically, but it's a very, very joyful song musically.
Thank you, Martin. It's been lovely talking to you today.
Thank you.
Dites-moi d'où il vient, enfin je saurai où je vais. Maman dit que lorsqu'on cherche bien, on finit toujours par trouver. Elle dit qu'il n'est jamais très loin, qu'il part très souvent travailler. Maman dit travailler c'est bien, bien mieux qu'être mal accompagné. Pas vrai? Où est ton papa? Dis-moi où est ton papa? Sans même devoir lui parler, il sait ce qui ne va pas. Ah sacré papa, dis-moi où es-tu caché? Ça doit faire au moins mille fois que j'ai compté mes doigts. Hey. Où t'es, papa, où t'es?